Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities with Lisa Zimmer. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I have a wonderful guest that I've been so excited to introduce to you guys. He is author and psychotherapist, Don Mortesini, and he has written several books. The one we're going to talk about today is called Princes and Ogres, The Integration of Psyche and Soul. And Don is a clinical psychotherapist in the San Jose, California area for over 18 years. He has an extensive background in both psychology and Eastern thought. And following 4 years as a naval officer, he became a stockbroker and 20 years later culminated his career as a vice president of Dean Witter & Company. At the height of his success, he asked himself, is this all there is? So unable to assuage the disquieting voice inside, he abandoned his career to pursue a life of meaning. So without further ado, let me introduce to you author and psychotherapist Don Mortesini, author of Princes and Ogres. Don, thank you so much for being my guest today on Unlimited Realities. Welcome, welcome.
Well, good morning, Lisa. I'm on the Pacific Coast, so it's morning. I am just delighted to be here. I'm going to look forward to our show so much.
I have been. It has been, you know, I absolutely loved your book, Princes and Ogres, The Integration of Psyche and Soul, because you hit upon so many areas that, you know, in our everyday awakening and trials and tribulations, there's so many things that we struggle to strive through and improve upon or increase more happiness within our life. And yet there's so many teachings and approaches out there that can be confusing. And what I loved about your book is that you really delved into the psyche, the human nature, the humanity of who we are as people, and not just judging ourselves and leaving it at that, but looking at that and seeing the beauty of our imperfection to evolve through it. And I really, really valued such wisdom and such prolific just writing. Your writing is just really, it takes you really into the heart. You have incredible stories. You have incredible wisdoms and teachings throughout here. So let's start off, first of all, with, let's describe what is our psyche in regard to our soul.
Okay. let me begin there. Okay. Well, I'm going to talk about the mind, okay? Basically,
sure.
The mind has different functions. The most primitive function that grew out of the instinctual nature of ourself is the ego. And the ego's job is self-preservation. That's why when you're driving a car, you don't drive through a red light or walk down a dark alley at night. It's also why you collect your correct change when you go to the supermarket. And it does all these simplistic things. And the ego is built by the time the child is a year and a half, 2 years old, and it's pretty much cemented in by the time it's 8 or 10 years old. So its functioning is primitive, and its thinking is primitive. But during that time, this is the most primitive part of the thinking brain. It sees things in black and white, on and off, self-centeredness, these kinds of things. So it's not the kind of mind we want to steward our lives from. We also have an intellect, and we can develop that intellect so that we can make decisions in complicated situations and so forth. Now, over that, around it, and through that, we are conscious beings. And we are, what this means is that this consciousness that we are is an eternal kind of a phenomena, okay? And it is over the highest intellect or highest learning that we can achieve. And part of our job, or I think a main part of our job, is not only to develop our intellect, but also to tap into our consciousness and bring forth the infinite amount of data and knowledge that's available to us to allow us to develop, not only personally, but spiritually as well.
Right. And in the discovering of, you know, you also have a private practice with,
yeah,
with clients, and some of the stories throughout your book really get into certain personality traits or characteristics. And one of the aspects that one of the stories that really was interesting to me, being I'm being an intuitive, but also having a very developed analytical side of myself, I really resonated to your story that you included in regard to Bonnie and Jake, where Bonnie had a very creative part of her personality, where she was trained as a school teacher, went to school for a teacher, met her husband Jake in college, and he was studying engineering. And she kind of like cowered down to his strength, if you will, or even control that you and I had just been talking about, it as how it creeps in when we don't even realize it. Let's talk a little bit about the ego there with Jake and the intuitive aspect with her, because there were definitely personality traits that could have derailed this marriage, and oftentimes have derailed many marriages, because even though the marriages can be together for many years, there's a distancing that can happen within long-term relationships where one another takes each other for granted and really doesn't see the value of the other person, of what they're bringing to the table. And in this case, Jake was actually seeing his wife as less than him because she wasn't bringing a monetary equality to the table in regard to the family dynamic. Can we talk a little bit about this relationship and how...
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting relationship. I changed the names, but this couple was a wonderful couple. Let me tell you, they adopted two children from India, Lisa. So they were really, really beautiful people. And
right.
They both had gone to the University of California and got advanced degrees. But Jake was an engineer, was a brilliant engineer. And she was a creative soul. She was in touch with her feminine nature. And she went into education. And even during her college years, he would denigrate her studies as inferior because they weren't math and science or physics oriented. And so where Jake was stuck, he was stuck in his ego one-upmanship, and our egos do this. We compare and we evaluate, and we tend to look down or make ourselves better when we do these comparisons. Nobody does these comparisons without the ego doesn't do these comparisons without seeking to enhance itself. Now Jake wasn't aware of this, but he was doing this, and so what happened? She was forgetful. Okay, she had a little ADD. It wasn't a problem. I'm gonna take a sip of coffee here.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But she'd forget this or that. So every time she might leave the keys in the car or something like that, he would be on her. And pretty soon it became a parent-child relationship where he was chewing her out because he was better and smarter and remembered more than she did. In the meantime, she was putting on these plays for children, and she put on a play, the Ramayana, which is a great Indian epic. These were for third and fourth graders. This is the kind of talented woman she was. She led from the heart, obviously, but she didn't feel good about herself because also, you know, she felt she was one down. The ego has two modes of operation, basically, has many, but one is sort of ego upmanship, you know, I'm better than you, and the other is a sense of inadequacy. And for whatever reason, she had a little sense of inadequacy. And Jake fed on this. And it wasn't until we got together that we were able to pull them out of this ego domination and bring them together, because they did these wonderful things. They raised these children they took from foreign countries, and it was a real eye-opener when finally Jake appreciated the fact that his wife, being musical and being theater-oriented and being a great teacher, provided something that was just as valuable as what he was providing. So I like that story, you know, very, very much.
Right. And it's all, you know, one of the things in regard to so much talk about ego is, one thing is we all have one. And what can we do in regard to, you know, oftentimes our ego can run away with ourselves, where the ego takes over and we're mindlessly kind of operating on this automatic pilot of kind of heavy nasty. But the ego is a very important, pertinent part of who we are to really use as a barometer in regard to keeping ourselves in check. How can we strengthen our healthy aspects of our ego while we're evaluating or looking at ourselves that where our ego kind of like impedes upon our growth or takes over.
Okay, that's a good question. You see, the thing is, as you said, the ego protects us. We talked about that earlier. But now the problem is, see, it wants to protect us from pain. It doesn't want us to get run over or hit by a truck or hurt ourselves, okay?
Right.
It oversteps itself, Lisa, when it wants to protect us from emotional pain, emotional discomfort, emotional vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it oversteps itself. So one way to know when you're an ego is if you're feeling any emotion at all. That is coming from ego.
Ah.
It doesn't matter. See, any emotion you feel has to emanate from a thought process that is in the realm of ego. And this and this comes from your childhood development. So anytime you're emotional, someone cuts you off on the road, you get upset. Or maybe someone doesn't show up on time and you feel, oh, they don't care about me. You're feeling some kind of a feeling, any kind of feeling, any kind of emotion. You are an ego mind. So what you can do, you can say, what thoughts led to me feeling inadequate because someone showed up an hour late, even if they do show up an hour late. And you go down and say, well, let's see here, you know, I think that they don't respect me. I think that I'm not worthwhile, I'm being met on time. And you begin to get into the dialogue that's in yourself that locks you into that position anytime something similar like that occurs. Then you can say, okay, I'm an ego mind. This is child mind. This is black and white thinking. This has got nothing to do with it. Basically, I am making myself upset, and I am telling myself I am inadequate because someone outside there who lives in their own universe didn't meet me when I thought he would. It's got nothing to do with my self-worth or my adequacy or inadequacy. So it's the feeling tones and the emotions that will let you know that you are an ego mind. So then you're an ego mind, and you can say, uh-oh. Oh, I have a couple themes. I have one theme of being not quite good enough. I have a theme of maybe being abandoned, or I have other themes like this. I like to even number the themes. Number three is activated for me. Somebody didn't show up on time or give me a present on my birthday or something like this. And all of a sudden the self-talk starts like, boom, I'm an ego mind, theme number three. At that point, I disidentify from the ego and use my intellect to analyze what's going on, and I then step out of it. And when I do that and allow that emotion to go through me, I realize that emotion is built on something that happened when I was 6, 8, 10, or 12 years old. It has got nothing to do with the present or my present worthwhileness. So it's the feeling tone, it's the emotion, it's the soft spots we feel that tell us we are in a wrong place of mind to make a decision, that we're in the lowest thinking part of our mind, the ego.
Now, in our lowest part of our ego, the aspect I loved, which was a continuing theme through this book, was to take the ego, to look at it, to not banish it, but to love it in a way where it evolves it from its infancy stage into really more of an evolved stage.
I call the ego the ogre, okay? I almost cut you off. I'm so sorry because I'm excited about talking.
No, go ahead.
But
not at
all. The thing is this. Let's take the story that you're waiting for someone. They don't show up for 45 minutes, or it's your birthday. You don't get a present, and you're feeling down on yourself. They don't care about me. I'm not important. I'm inadequate, or whatever the feeling could be. And you all of a sudden you say, "Oops, that's Dawn's theme number one." Okay. Now I am creating my feelings of low self-esteem with my self-talk that's got nothing to do with what that person is doing out there in the world, okay? So
right.
I get that. That's important point number one. Then I can say, okay, well, that's just self-talk. And I am creating this as a theme. So what I can do is the more that I can step back and breathe, I can allow that feeling to flow through me and release it and not be run by it all day long that I'm unhappy because I'm not very good.
Right.
And so the thing is, when I catch it, I then say, I don't want to feel like this. I am creating this misery for myself. Before, I didn't know I was doing this, but now I'm aware that I'm doing it. And so I choose not to be here. And that's not my nature. All of us are equally wonderful. All of us are equally beautiful. All of us are equally spiritual beings. And so I can say, okay, time for me to get out of that hole. And I certainly don't want to make any decisions from it. And so the best way to do it is to use the breath, because the breath quiets the mind. If I just breathe for 10 seconds or 15 seconds, I send endorphins to my mind, but my mind quiets. I don't have thoughts. And in that process, I go to a state of consciousness momentarily that will take me out of that place. Now, that doesn't mean that the ego may want to come back and protect me from hurt and try to defend me, but I can see that process happening.
Right.
And I can then let it go. It's just an energy. That's all it is. It's an energy wave that goes through me. I can witness it. If I breathe, and there's a story in the book about witnessing, if I breathe, I can witness that energy as an urge or a feeling coming through me. And if I'm transparent to that because I'm conscious and witnessing up of it, it will just move through me because there's no resistance.
And would you feel that a lot of our struggles are created, like self-sabotage and all of these struggles we put upon ourselves, really do are based within our ego and how we can look at that to kind of shift that awareness?
Every problem in the world and all the evil that exists arises out of the self-seeking, self-centered, myopic, primitive, black-and-white thinking ego. Take a look. Take a look at the Penn State scandal. Well, all these boys were molested, and this was horrific. And the trial is going on now. And the cover-up from all these people, all these educators, for years and years and years. Why? Because they were stuck in ego self-preservation. Ego myopic thinking, I got to take care of me. I don't want to blow the whistle. And these youngsters' lives were being ruined.
Right, right. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where we see so much within our current modern world. But, you know, ego existed forever. It exists within the human, you know, confines of who we are, our psyche, and it's up to us and our evolving soul and perception and awareness to really move through that. And you mentioned in the book the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna used the battlefield as a staging ground. Can we talk a little bit about that, because there's a beautiful passage there you have. Go ahead.
I didn't tie together your last question. What I do is, when I catch my ego doing this, say my wife comes home late and I'm expecting that she's going to do this, and she gets caught at work or something like that, I might feel a little bit of, oh, here we go again. I catch it. But then what I do, I talk to my ego. And I say, I know you feel bad. I know you don't feel good. And it's okay. I talk to it. By talking to it, I really separate out from it. I said, just let it go. Not a biggie. It's okay. I appreciate you. I appreciate you trying to take care of me. I appreciate you trying to protect me from emotional harm. I appreciate you trying to protect me from being small or feeling poorly. I appreciate your intent. It's just not working. I kind of pat it on the head. I wanted to wrap that up because that was part of the question you asked me before. And that's something
that's great.
I do. Okay, because I think it's important. I've got the book here. Let me just pull it out here. This is the story of the Bhagavad Gita. First of all, the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavan in Sanskrit means Lord. Gita in Sanskrit means song. And so it's one of the greatest epic poems of all time. It's considered the Hindu Bible. And I like to read exactly, because I'm quoting, the Bhagavad Gita, page 74. I'm quoting exactly from this great epic poem. So what happens is basically there's a war going on between two parties, and there's a young archer. His name is Arjuna, and the Lord comes down to advise Arjuna how to live his life, basically, because he is faced in battle with an army that he is supposed to go ahead and fight, and he doesn't want to do this because he said, I don't know that this is correct. And so Krishna comes in to give him advice, and this is the first chapter of the Gita. So, quote, two opposing armies are ready to clash. Arjuna, the greatest archer of his time, stands in his chariot, trumpets blazing, banners flying, war drums rumbling, conch shells, horns blazing. He looks down at the mightiest army he has witnessed, and he is filled with fear. But as he looks closer, he sees on the other side, quote, fathers, grandfathers, sons, grandsons, fathers of wives, uncles, brothers, companions, and friends. Overcome with grief, he says, life drains from my limbs, and my mouth is seared and dry. I'm overcome with horror, and the great bow I have falls from my hands. And that, what Arjuna is facing, this is metaphor. At a symbolic level, Arjuna, the greatest archer of his time, is facing the battle of his soul, which is tossed between the forces of good and evil. As he falls to his knees, the opposing army, and this is so important, are the thoughts and ideas in his mind. They are man's selfishness, man's anger, man's lust, thoughtlessness, cruelty, self-absorption, aggression, judgment, discrimination, blame, greed, inadequacy, victimhood. He also fights the self-limiting idea that he is less than capable of winning this battle. Then Krishna, who is in his chariot, his higher consciousness, the Lord or higher consciousness, says to Arjuna, think thou of thy duty and do not waver. There is no greater good for a war than to fight this war, i.e. the war of the self. And to forego this fight is to fall into transgression. So the message is clear, I write, without these tumultuous battles, inner battles to spur us on, we would never reach deep within our psyche and allow the Lord, ask Krishna, that which makes us a fully spiritual individual.
Right.
Never move into that state. So the war, the jihad, the battle we must engage is an inner battle. It's the battle between the desire of our lower senses and desires and higher states of consciousness which reside in the soul or the self. And Krishna says, all is clouded by desire. Wisdom is clouded by desire. Passion is the enemy of the soul. And Krishna tells Arjuna, kill therefore with the sword of wisdom the doubt born of ignorance that lies in your ego. And this is taken word for word from one of the greatest epics of its time. And then over the next 10 chapters, the Lord advises Krishna how to do this, how to focus his attention on the Lord, how to raise his consciousness, how to begin to realize that he is an eternal entity, and how to begin to access those states of consciousness. But I like that because it shows that Arjuna is every man. And let me add one thing. The reason I write the way I do is because I have a teacher, my spiritual teacher, Sri Anandama in India, and she taught the way that great sages taught 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. At that time, the whole world was pretty much illiterate, except for the very educated class. So great, great saints and sages and spiritual giants like Jesus and Buddha and Lao Tse and so many others would crisscross the country, and they would tell stories. And that's how the Bhagavad Gita finally came into written form. And they will tell stories, and people will remember the stories because there would be a message, a truth message embedded in it. Just like the truth message we talked about today. And
right.
So I decided when I wrote, I wanted to write and take these stories that have been forgotten. Some of them go back 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago from ancient sources, and some are a little bit modern, and show that the truth never varies. And I take a story like the Bhagavad Gita, or I take other stories that we can go into, and the stories are wonderful, and they're catchy, and they've got hooks in them, and the people would remember the story, and then they remember the teaching, and they could apply it. And then the itinerant spiritual teacher would come around the next year to that village and would tell another story. And then the people
right.
remember that and then apply it. And that's the way in which I kind of wrote the book. I wrote it with these great stories that have, for the most part, just been lost in the dust of time. I pull out the kernel of truth in them and then show how, like in the story we talked about the couple, about Jake, how that can be applied today so that we don't get stuck there in our ego. And I'm so glad you mentioned the Bhagavad Gita because it's my favorite reading of all time. I love it, and if I've read it once, I've probably read it 150 times because its
right.
teachings are so profound.
It's a wonderful book. It really is. And there's such richness and depth in each story. So it's like you get something new each time you read the story
mm-hmm.
again and again and again. There's one story that we're talking about, and I find this is something that resonated to me because I'm working through this myself.
Uh-huh.
But it is the story about Sita's kitchen renovation and redecorating.
Oh, yeah.
And it tells of a lovely story of this woman who had a very difficult time receiving compliments. And I will let you take it from there so you can put your insight on this.
Well, the thing is, you know, Sita came into my office and she was a little depressed and I asked her about herself and I forget what her occupation was now, but I said, well, you know, what else do you do? Well, she's fixing my house. Oh, that's great. I said, what are you working on? I said, I'm working on the kitchen. I said, well, where are you? Well, she said, I'm tearing up the floor and I'm going to put a new floor down. I said, well, who'd you hire? And, oh, I didn't hire, but I'm doing this myself. I said, you're kidding. I said, you're gonna you know, pull the floor up and put it down? Oh, yeah, I can do that real easily. And so I didn't pay, well, first visit or second, I didn't pay much attention to it. She just comes back a week or two later. What are you working on now? I'm going to work on the cupboards or the cabinets. I said, oh, so you're going to get a cabinet maker? Oh, no. I'll just take all the cabinets off and off the hinges and everything else, and I'm going to do all this woodworking. And I said, Sita, I said, I couldn't do something like that. I said, where'd you learn to do that? I said, oh, my father was a carpenter, and he taught me this stuff. And every time I'd see Sita, she was doing this incredible renovation, and she was doing it herself. I said, that's incredible. I couldn't approach doing that.
Right.
I said, it's nothing. It's nothing at all. You know, it's what I learned. And what Sita was doing, everything that she did, every talent she created, she denigrated and said, it's nothing because my father taught me.
Mm-hmm.
And she was totally stuck in a deep sense of inadequacy and helplessness. In the meantime, all these things that she had accomplished didn't mean anything because they were taught to her or she copied her father or did something else like this. And it was such an interesting story because finally, in the end, I said to her, you know, has anybody learned anything? The reason
right,
we go
right.
to school, the reason we complete high school, the reason we go to graduate school, the reason we get our degrees is because we're taught, and you were learned and taught all these things, and you denigrate them. Yet the rest of the world learns these various things, whether it's in physics or it's in education or whatever it is, and they feel good about it.
Right, right.
And so it took a while for her to begin to see that she was putting herself down for the good things she did because they were easy and she knew how to do them, and then the things for which she was not trained and did not have knowledge and compared herself against others who did have those skills, she put herself down. Because the mind always compares, and for whatever reason, Her mind always took a comparison of someone who did something better and made her less than, and where she did something better, there was a reason for it because she had been taught or shown how to do it. So it was a real, real interesting story to show how powerful the ego is when it grasps onto a concept like low self-esteem or
inadequacy
or whatever it might be. And it took a long time for she to begin to see through different colored glasses that we all learn and we all try our best and that there is no higher or lower. And so that was a long session. Steve and I worked for a long time together on that one.
You know, it was very interesting because I see that pretty common, and it seems to be pretty prevalent in many women's inherent makeup, where they kind of are a little bit. And I can't generalize and say all women, but a good majority, majority of women struggle with their self-worth because of, and it's this comparative, you know, look at how they're comparing themselves to other women or comparing their worth or their value or what they've done or what they haven't done to somebody else. And I know men do it more in a professional realm or maybe in a competitive realm or sports realm. It seems like when men are doing it, though, it's a different internalized survival mechanism, or it's an internal, a different internalization than how women internalize.
What happens, Lisa, is that all minds, all ego minds compare. For example, I'm seeing a boy now, and he's a senior in high school, and he's getting A's, and he's taken 3 AP classes, which are advanced classes, okay?
Right.
And he's comparing himself to this kid who's taken 5 classes and who is an athlete, and he thinks he's nothing.
Right.
So I'm working with him every Friday. So what happens, the mind always compares, and will always find someone who does something better and then compare you to someone who is particularly skilled at that and say, you're not that good. And it goes across the board. Now, the themes for men and women can be more gender-specific, which is what you're talking about. But the process, the egoic process, is the same. One of the themes we're working on is developing a sense of self, developing our self-esteem, feeling better about ourselves, then our mind is going to do the same comparison, take someone who's excelled at someone and compare ourselves to it. To this boy, I said to himself, how come you're not comparing yourself to all the C students at your school? And here you're getting A's and 3 AP classes, and you're comparing yourself to one guy who's taken 2 more. Oh, well,
right.
Because, you know, he gave me all kinds of crazy excuses. So this is what the mind does. But the issues, as you say, are somewhat gender-specific.
Right.
But the process is the same. It makes unfair comparisons in order to, and the reason it does it makes unfair comparisons in order to make you feel not too good. So let's take a social situation, because I've run into this. A woman said, I don't like to go to socials because I don't really know how to dress well, and I'm not that good at small talk and this kind of thing. And I'll say, well, at the last one, you know, who'd you go to who'd you look at? Well, I looked at the hostess, and she dressed like $1 million, and she greeted everybody, and she flew and everything. I said, how come you didn't compare yourself to the wallflowers or to the women who are hanging on husband's arms and were pale and didn't say anything? I said, why don't you compare yourself also to those who have more trouble than you rather than to the hostess who is gifted in this area of activity? And so,
right.
So basically, the mind will take and make a comparison if one doesn't feel good and find someone with more skill or does something better so it can compare itself and put itself down. The reason it did that for this woman is her ego wanted her not to go so she wouldn't be embarrassed. It wanted to protect her from harm. Remember I said the ego wants to protect you from emotional vulnerability, emotional harm. So she would talk to her husband and say, I prefer not to go, or let's just go for a few minutes or like that. So ego's trying to protect her, but in protecting her, it's keeping her limited because the thinking it's using is faulty.
Ah. So interesting. I've learned so much already, and we're only halfway through. This is a wonderful show, Don. Thank you so much for your wisdom.
I'm so glad we got half hour to go. Lisa, love being with you.
This is great. This is wonderful. Such a gift. Now, we're going to get into different aspects parts that you talked about within your book, like spiritual bypassing. Let's talk about what is spiritual bypassing.
Okay. Actually, spiritual bypassing, I talk about, is praying to God or to the source for help with things that we can get down our arms and knees and rope our sleeves and do ourselves.
Okay.
And so, that's the short end of it. So what it means is, something doesn't go right. So rather than seek out the services in our community, rather than pull help to ourselves, rather than work on an issue, we pray to God to take care of it. Okay, that's kind of like spiritual bypassing what we're supposed to do. See, the thing is, we are 100% human beings, and we are 100% spiritual beings. And it's like Jesus said, give unto Caesar those things that are Caesar, unto God the things that are God. And if we're working on Caesar's stuff and we're praying God to take care of it, then we're spiritually bypassing. Does that make sense?
Okay. It does. It does make sense. Because, there's this piece of us in our human nature, in our fears and our assumptions of what life is going to be or what our rewards or punishments are going to be. And there's almost a fear of taking responsibility sometimes for the things that we can do or we have control over. And there's a fine line between having control over the actions that we can change and alter, and then surrendering. And let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, the thing is this. See, Lisa, there are no two snowflakes alike.
Right.
And there are no two flowers alike. And every snowflake and every flower and every human being is needed. And we're all different and unique in some particular aspect of way. And part of our job as human beings is to find out who we are and to bring that talent and that uniqueness and richness to its fullest so that the world can benefit from us and then the diversity of everybody else who is in deep alignment with themselves and their talents and gifts and abilities and polish those. Now, what we do is we polish ourselves, we work, we put out, and we don't get the result back that we might expect. All I can do is go back to the Gita and say, Krishna said, you're responsible for the quality of the work, the fruits are up to the gods. So you do your best, and then you let go, because then you can stand and say, I did my best. And what happens may be that I do not get what I think I want, but I am coming from a level of awareness where I don't understand that other things might be coming to me that are more important for me to have, or deprived from my efforts so that I can learn about myself, or I could be paying back some kind of karmic debt. So we do our best, and we put it out there. And then really the results are for the gods. But if we don't get back what we want, and this is so important, so they're crying and they're praying to God and bleeding like a sheep and begging God to give us what we want, and we're coming from our limited intellect telling the source what to give us, it's ridiculous. So the whole thing is we do our best, and then we give it, put it out there with our hand open and say, this is yours, I let go, thy will be done.
Right.
And that's our job. Krishna said, the fruits are up to the gods. The work is up to you. Do thy work. The fruits are up to the gods. I just don't want to quote Krishna, but it just so happens that we talked about the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's... It's perfect. It's timely. And you know, in the spiritual bypassing, I find that it's kind of a convenience for many in their use of really not dealing with the things that they fear. And a lot of times it's the fear of their own vulnerability that they will use something to kind of, you know, bypass that emotion or that icky feeling or that, you know, that throbbing heart or the grief or whatever it is that's going on. And it can be a little bit of a crutch, wouldn't you say, in some ways, that we...
Absolutely, yeah. Why isn't God listening to me? Here, I did my job, what's happened? As if,
right.
as if we live in a quid pro quo universe. The universe is very,
right.
very complex, and things, and there are so many things that take place. We are vibrations. That's what we are. You know, we resonate at certain frequencies. We put out certain things. We are on this planet we're on this planet for three reasons. One, to procreate. That's clear. Now, we don't have to. The second is to find out what we are about, what our talent skill is about, and to just polish that to the utmost, and then give it to life. And then let go whether the results come in that we think or not, because we will be getting something that's important for us from an intelligence higher than ours. And the third
right.
thing is to delve into spirit and discover that we are eternal beings, that we have a soul, that we have a self, and dive as deep as we can into the richness of that self.
Right, right. And, you know, there's this piece of almost fear sometimes where, you know, it's not so much, I forget who says this, maybe Zig Ziglar, but it's not so much that we, and I'm paraphrasing, that we fear our failures as much as we fear our greatness. And sometimes there's that intimidation we create for ourselves, of ourselves.
Well, the thing is this, remember, you're talking all about mind. We're not talking about spirit or consciousness. At a level of consciousness, we can step back and say, I put this out. Now, if I don't get back what I want to be aware to see what comes to me, because it will be a teaching or a benefit I didn't think about or something else. So Zig Ziglar and the rest, and I respect Zig, because when I was a salesman, stockbroker, you know, I read all his books.
Right.
But basically, he's working at a level of reality
right.
that ignores a higher level of reality, which is the level of spirit, the level of consciousness, the level of soul, okay?
Gotcha.
And so if we stay in the material realm and forget the fact that we are on a path of personal evolution and personal spiritual evolution, that what we do in the material sphere, if it doesn't come back, it is about our own evolution into higher states of consciousness so that we can experience the beauty and the quietude, the peace, the joy, the oneness that comes as we go deeper and deeper into the soul.
Right, right. And in getting back into our soul, there's a part here, there's a story you talk about Naomi where she is a bit of a spiritual doormat. Now, when we get into our soul and we are really trusting our heart, we're dropping down into our feelings and our emotions, and we're moving from this unconditional peace of love and really, really working to reflect and put that energy out there for others so that what we emanate is of love, of peace, of light, and not of control and manipulation and fear and all of that. So where does that piece of spiritual doormat come in? Where
okay,
does that
but,
piece...
what, I like that story because I didn't want to appear to denigrate the ego. I said at the beginning of our show, we need the ego to take care of us physically and in so many, many, many ways. And the ego wants to put bread on the table and have our children get their education and do all these things. However, when it tries to protect us from vulnerability and pain and this kind of thing, it oversteps its boundaries. Now, in Naomi's case, she was a gifted intuitive, okay? And she would have a tray there, leave your donation. And what would happen is people come to her and she'd do a reading and they wouldn't leave any money. They'd leave her just a small amount of money, and they'd be calling her at 10, 11 o'clock at night for advice and this kind of stuff. And so finally I said to her, I said, look, Naomi, you also live in the material world and you need to have boundaries. You need to take care of yourself. And that's the story where I said, I taught her the story of the snake that wouldn't hiss. Let me just go into that a minute. This was a classic spiritual story. The story is this sage, this holy man, goes into the village and he gets his teaching. He leaves by way of the jungle. And people say, don't go there, don't go there. There's this terrible snake, he'll eat you alive. And the holy man goes by and he sees this terrible snake. And the snake says to him, oh, holy man, I would like to be spiritual. I'm very bad. I bite and eat and I hurt people. And so the holy man says, fine. So spend some time with him, gives him a blessing, goes on his way. A year later, he comes back and he hears this creaky voice that can hardly speak. And the snake says, hello, holy man. The holy man says, I don't know who you are. He says, I'm the snake that you talked to last year and told to be spiritual, and not bite people, not maim them. And the snake, and the holy man says, my God, what happened to you? What happened to you? He said, I stopped biting people. And then gradually some brave children came up and they started teasing me, and then one picked me up. And, of course, I didn't bite. So then they began to shake me around. I still didn't bite. And they began to stomp on me and beat me up. And now I'm half dead. The holy man said to him, now, I said, don't bite. But I didn't say you couldn't hiss. In other words, so I use this ancient story to say you have to build boundaries because the world can be a dangerous place. So
right.
I use the story in Naomi's case, this place where I use a classic story that's been forgotten. So Naomi, now you need to build boundaries because people will take advantage of you, some will. So then you need to put a sign up, I charge so much for this, and I don't take calls after 6, or I have to charge you for telephone calls. And I want you to it took a while for her to feel comfortable doing this, but eventually she did this. So this was a case where she needed then to protect herself. She needed to draw boundaries so that she continued to bring her gift forth. And I did that to show that we live in this world and there are a lot of predators out there, and we need to learn how to hiss when it's appropriate to do it, going back to that story. And that was the story of Naomi.
And it was, it's very interesting because a lot of times people will place judgments upon those who work within the realm of spirit or spirituality or a teaching or an intuition or something like that. And the premise is that you should not get paid because you're working among a gift, or you're working among a spiritually based belief, practice, endeavor. And so how can healthy boundaries be developed by somebody who has a struggle or a challenge with identifying what boundaries need to be made, or even what boundaries are? Because, boundaries are one of those very, very important factors of living peacefully and simply. I find tweaking my boundaries are always very helpful to peace of mind and balance within my lifestyle.
Well, the thing is this, whether you work spiritually as a minister, whether you're working doing some spiritual outreach, whether you are intuitive, doing psychic readings, it doesn't matter, because you're working in the material universe with the gifts that you have, which are given you so that you can support yourself materially, period.
Right.
And so, if your accountant asks for so much when you visit him for an hour, and your attorney asks so much for visiting him for an hour because that is his talent, and
right,
you happen to be a talented intuitive and counselor, and you help people, you also need them to say, I require this much an hour so that I can put food on the table and raise my children and do the rest. And so basically that thought is just, first of all, it doesn't make sense at all, because that is your talent, which the world needs. Like I said, no two snowflakes, no two flowers alike, but we need all of them. Well, why should some snowflakes, why should some flowers, why should some people provide service and get remuneration for it and others not. It doesn't make sense at all. So what it
right.
is, it's just an incorrect thought by people who don't understand.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, how can we look at ourselves and sometimes even look at ourselves where we're sabotaging our life or our future because of pride or because of unhealthy boundaries or maybe even not having boundaries? How can we look at that and tweak that a little bit within our lives?
Well, the thing is this. If you don't have good boundaries, people are going to begin to take advantage of you. You're going to start overgiving, and that'll work for a while. But then, guess what? You begin to build a little resentment, or you begin to think that life isn't fair. And as you begin to have these thoughts, or as you have these feelings of resentment, or life isn't fair, that's the message to yourself to do something about it.
Right. Right.
Now,
and then
words,
it's a matter
there's no free ride in life in terms of personal growth and in terms
right.
of spiritual growth. So if things don't come back harmoniously to you, it means you're on the side of the road. And you got to say, how did I get here on the side of the road?
Right.
It's just feedback to you is what it is, Lisa.
Yes, yes. And it's a matter of what you put out there and what you create, it's going to come back. It's a matter of just really putting your priorities and your definitive boundaries in place and consistency with them. Because it's one thing to place the boundaries there, but if you're not consistent in following up and honoring those boundaries, what's the benefit of having them?
Well, if you put a boundary out there and then you pull it back for a week and you put it back out there and pull it back for a week, you'll drive your patients, clients crazy and yourself crazy too. No,
exactly.
So basically you want to say, and a lot of people who have good boundaries don't feel good about themselves, maybe have a little sense of inadequacy or a little embarrassment about what they're doing or something like that. And so that too then is an invitation to probe down there and say, do I have any feelings, any thoughts that might be contributing to the fact that I don't want to put up appropriate boundaries? To have any thoughts
right.
that may not be appropriate, that may be a little distorted because they're coming out from that more primitive thinking part of my mind, my ego. Is there anything I need to investigate there? Why it's difficult for me to ask for appropriate remuneration? And you'll get in touch with maybe a little sense of inadequacy or maybe some low self-esteem or something like this. Oh, that's what's going on. No wonder I'm not asking for my fair return. And so then. Then, again, you go the process. You feel the feeling and say, well, you know, it's appropriate for me to do this. It is in my integrity for me to do this. This is the way the material world works. I'm going to survive. I need to do this. And then you feel the feelings. You feel the fear that you may not be inadequate and people may turn you down. And you go through that process. And then you set your boundaries. You ask for your pay or ask for whatever it is you need. And you, in the process of doing that, then those feelings and emotions, as they come up, you allow them to come up and they go through and eventually they dissipate because they're not infinite in nature.
And you have this real ease in your explanation in regard to just taking the elephant out of the room or like looking at the elephant that's in the room and making it this benevolent creature that's not so scary and not unsolvable and to really break it down in manageable pieces where we can look at ourselves and we can look at what needs to be done and what we have done and reestablish what value and priority we want in our life. And that's what I really found throughout Princes and Ogres, is that you took very tangible realities of lives of people, and you brought such a spiritual insight and wisdom into the teaching of it, into the lesson. And it was so easily applied. It was one of those books that you read and you keep reading another page and it's like, aha, ah, aha. And that's how I was through your whole book. So it's one of those books I encourage all our listeners today, Princes and Ogres, Don Mortesini. It's the integration of the psyche and soul. It's a wonderful read. You won't put it down. You'll start it and you'll read it from beginning to end in the first read. It's a very easy but comprehensible and understandable, insightful, wise reading. And Don, just thank you so much for having written this book. You've also written a book about I just want to mention this briefly because we've had about 5 minutes left, and I want our listening audience to understand. You wrote Wild Child, How to Help Your Child with ADD and Other Behavioral Issues, and that came out in 2001. And you are, in this book, Princes and Ogres, combining the power and wisdom of myth with grounded psychology to show how we can live a more balanced life in Princes and Ogres, the integration of psyche and soul. And that was just released this year in 2012. What would you like to impart upon our listeners today? We have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to refer them to you, if to your website or however you would like to finish out the last 5 minutes with your wisdom, Don.
Okay, to do a quick wrap. We're 100% spiritual beings, 100% material. And the things we've talked about have been more in the material realm. And the book would be very helpful to allow you to move through those things you need to move through, to in other words, to grow personally and to bring to you more of the good that lies in potential for you in the material realm. Now, if you don't do that, it's going to be very difficult to then evolve spiritually, because you'll be sad or upset, you didn't get this, that didn't work out, or blaming God or whatever. So it's kind of important to take care of both parts of yourself. That's one thing I want to say. And the book talks about the ego, how it helps you and how it hinders you. The stories are great. You read a story, you'll remember it, and you'll be able to apply the teaching. As far as the book goes, I just wanted to write this the way books were written 3,000 years ago, and everybody's read it. They love the stories. They're about 50 wisdom stories. They've lost the dust of time, and they're great. You can get it on my website. My name, DonMortesini.com. I sell it at the price of the book. I cover all shipping. So you can get it on my website. You can go to Amazon. It's in book form on Amazon. I convert it to an e-book. Those are a couple of probably the easiest places. It's on Nook if you go to Barnes & Noble. Or you can go to a bookstore and just tell them, spell my name, Don Mortesini, and ask them to order the book for you. Also, I do post on Facebook, and I try to post messages that I think are helpful to people. I like Facebook, and I'd welcome any listeners to join me as a Facebook friend. I think that is pretty much what it is. The cover of the book is black, and it shows the sun covered by eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love it.
And what that cover represents, it depicts our ego, which I call the ogre, because it can get pretty nasty, okay, limiting the infinite spiritual and material good that is our birthright. Our discriminating mind and our consciousness must master the ogre. Notice, we don't kill the ego. We must master the ogre to let the light shine, or we eclipse ourselves. And that's the story of the cover of the book, and it's what the book is about. That bring to you all the good that's available to you in your material life and to evolve spiritually as deeply as you can.
That is such a beautiful metaphor, Don. I truly, truly love that. That is such an eclipse. And a beautiful eclipse of the soul. I just absolutely love that. Don, this has been absolutely one of my all-time favorite interviews. You are such a delight. I have absolutely loved having you on Unlimited Realities today. And I look forward to any other wisdom you'd like to impart. At any other point, we can get you on the show, because you're just such a wealth of information and wisdom. I've learned so much today. And I thank you again so much for joining us and gracing us with your beautiful wisdom and personality and essence. And thank you, thank you, thank you, Don. And listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in today to Unlimited Realities and our guest today, Don Mortesini. And his book today that we're discussing is Princes and Ogres, Integration of Psyche and Soul. And let me spell out his name for you for his website. It would be www.donmordasini.com. And that's donmordasini.com. Thank you again, Don. God bless you. Thank you for coming on, and have a wonderful weekend.
Well, listen, I love this, Lisa. I just appreciated being with you so much, and I thank you for your invitation. Thank you so very much.
Oh, you've been delightful. Thank you so much, Don. God bless you. Have a wonderful weekend. God bless everybody. Bye-bye.
Same to you, Lisa. Bye now.